Okay, we are going to get started. Thank you so much, everybody, for coming here today and for braving the weather and the winds outside to come to the talk. For our seminar series this week, we are very fortunate to have here with us Dr. Per Engström from University College London. Per completed his DPhil in International Relations here in Oxford at Mansfield College. Since then, he's moved to UCL, where he's a lecturer in Human Rights of the Americas, and is also the co-chair of the London Transitional Justice Network. Per is working on a number of issues, and in particular, he's been doing research on regional human rights institutions, with particular focus on the Inter-American System for the Protection of Human Rights. He's also been working on issues of judicialization of politics, transitional justice, foreign policy, and humanitarianism. And he's also worked and done research on a number of countries, including Argentina, Chile, Colombia, and also Brazil. And that's what he's going to talk to us about this afternoon, a recent research project on issues of post-transitional justice in Brazil and the Inter-American human rights system. Thank you very much for being here, Per.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Francesca. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for the invitation. And just add my thanks to you for all showing up on such a beautiful day like this. Now, let's just launch straight into what I hope to discuss here, because I know that there are quite a few people who know far more than I do when it comes to ongoing process of transition justice in Brazil. So really what I would like to kind of do, I think, is to highlight some of the themes that seems to be of interest to me and where I'm coming from, and then we could perhaps start a conversation about the significance of the various issues that I would like to address. So my talk today is really concerned with current process of post-transition justice in Brazil. And by this I mean, and I borrow here from Kath Collins, effectively the challenges to the early settlement, if you like, of transition justice in the period of the 1980s, and really interested in here the prospects for the revision of the transition era human rights settlement in Brazil. So the focus here of my remarks really will be on the role of the Inter-American human rights system for reasons that I hope will become apparent as we go along. And in particular, I would emphasize what types of transition justice policies may be required, if you like, from Brazil in light of the Gomes Lund ruling with regards to the Guerrilla da Araguaia. And this is the ruling of the Inter-American Court of Human Rights in November 2010. So what I thought would be helpful, at least for my own interest here, is to draw out some of the implications of this ruling and the Brazilian government's responses to it. And what that really tells us about the prospects for and limitations on Brazilian post-transitional justice, and arguably perhaps Brazilian democracy more broadly. And this is where I get into very interesting territory, perhaps. We'll see. But let me start by just saying a very few preliminary remarks on the Inter-American human rights system. The Inter-American human rights system, in my view, came of age through its engagement with transition justice. At the beginning of the 1980s, the Inter-American system was weakly institutionalized, and it was mainly a promotional regional human rights system consisting of a commission and a court without any cases. From the mid-1980s onwards, however, the Inter-American system started to increasingly insert itself into transition justice struggles in quite interesting ways. In particular, and this is the kind of main point here that I'd like you to take away from the Inter-American system here, is that it played a central role in construction of a set of rules, norms, and principles with regard to transition justice. Now, in the early stages of the transitions to democracy in the Southern Cone in the 1980s, the international influences on transition justice were fairly limited. Confronted with the dilemmas of transition justice, governments had few international precedents to draw from, broadly speaking. International human rights jurisprudence at the time were of limited concrete help in guiding policy decisions. Moreover, in the early transitional period, the Inter-American human rights system was quite weakly institutionalized, as I mentioned, and didn't really have a capacity to play an active role in the attempts to hold the military in particular accountable for human rights abuses. In terms of human rights activism, there were increasingly professionalized human rights NGOs that started to use the Inter-American system more actively as the 1980s progressed, but the learning process among these groups was still very much in incipient stages. However, the influence of the Inter-American system broadly would grow over time, especially as the system developed a jurisprudence that emphasized the right to truth and the right to individual judicial redress, access to justice, if you like. So more specifically, over time, the Inter-American system developed an increasingly robust position on the legitimacy of amnesty laws. Yeah? Most famously in the 2001 ruling in the Barrios Altos case with regards to Peru, the Inter-American Court ruled effectively that the auto-amnesty, the self-amnesty of the Fujimori regime, violated victims' rights of access to justice. And the Barrios Altos case, together with a number of subsequent cases related to amnesty provision in Chile, Uruguay, and of course, as we'll see, in Brazil, has consolidated the Inter-American system's position on impunity, yeah, and the kind of equivalence in the court's view of impunity and amnesty. And the court here has defined impunity as a systematic failure to investigate, to prosecute, to adjudicate, and convict those who are responsible for human rights violations that are protected by the relevant regional treaties. And its condemnation of impunity really is twofold. On the one hand, at an individual level, for victims and for family members, impunity fosters, in the words of the Inter-American Court, the total defenselessness of the victims and the next of kin, who have the right to know and to know the truth about the facts. But on the other hand, for society more broadly, collectively, impunity, and in the words of the court, fosters a chronic repetition of human rights violation. Yeah, we could argue with the, if you like, the empirical validity of these type of claims, but this is the kind of normative framework and understanding of amnesty laws, if you like, that have developed. So, following transition to democracy in Latin America, the Inter-American system has really played an important role in developing certain norms, standards regarding transition justice, and as they pertain to the scope of amnesty laws in particular. And the engagement of the Inter-American system with transition justice has given rise to a broad set of obligations that public authorities have, and that is with regards to accountability and reparations. And the key principles that the Inter-American system has developed in response to transition justice include a victim-oriented approach, effectively victim that is at the center of concerns with regards to transition justice, right to effective judicial remedy, i.e. fair trial and judicial protection, in other words, access to justice, and the right to truth, which has developed into a right in itself, if you like. And in his practice, the Inter-American Court in particular has developed an increasingly holistic, comprehensive approach to reparation policies. And if you look at the type of reparation policy up until very recently the Inter-American Court has put forward in his rulings, effectively it's a very long list of things that states need to do in order to repair harm done. Yeah, that spans from monetary reparations through to symbolic reparations in the form of commemorations, act of commemoration, through to institutional reforms and prosecution of individuals. So it's a very long list, a very ambitious set of demands that the court puts to states. Now, of course, there might be some lawyers here, and this is an obvious point, but it's also important to keep in mind. Now, the Inter-American system, of course, is a human rights entity, and as such, it has jurisdiction over states and can rule on state responsibility. It's not a criminal court per se, of course. It doesn't have jurisdiction over individuals. Now, However, in his practice, it has very much inserted itself into domestic criminal proceedings, and also in his effective demand of holding individuals to account domestically. It has developed a kind of a relevant position on the scope of criminal prosecution domestically. Yeah? If you like, this is the criminalization of human rights, politics, and law. That, of course, has more global relevance with International Criminal Court, of course, ICC. So there is, of course, a kind of quite apparent regional trend of post-transition justice that in the region of Latin America that increasingly perhaps challenged the political bargains of the democratic transitions. And this trend is most clearly seen, of course, in the rising number of human rights trials regarding the past that are underway in a number of countries in Latin America, including Argentina, Chile, to a certain extent Peru, perhaps Uruguay, of course, and most recently in Guatemala. Francesca has a more a gloomy view on if you like the scope of these prosecutions, but you know if you look at it from perhaps historically the actual steps taken towards prosecution is quite significant in a region if you like that you know if you look at it from the 1990s was in this area understood to be a region of impunity as a norm if you like. Anyway, now, before turning to transition justice in Brazil specifically, I think it might be useful to get some sense of the relationship between the Inter-American system and Brazil and how that relationship has developed over time. So there are perhaps three distinct yet overlapping dimensions of Brazil's relationship with the Inter-American system. First, the kind of degree of formal state commitment and government support to the system. Secondly, patterns of civil society mobilization and the depth and breadth, if you like, of domestic constitutionalization of the standards of the Inter-American system, as well as judicial attitudes towards the system. Now, let me just very, very briefly, I'll try to be as quick as possible because I want to get to the real issues here. Now, in terms of formal commitment to the regional human rights system, of course, Brazil's commitment formally is quite notable. Yeah? It has ratified all the main regional human rights treaties of the Inter-American human rights system. However, despite its ratification record, traditionally Brazil has not had a very clearly defined presence within the Inter-American system. And there's a number of reasons for this, if you like. In part, until quite recently, this relative neglect of the regional human rights system could be partly explained by the fact that Brazilian government's engagement with international human rights tended to be beyond the region, towards the UN, if you like. Brazil was, for example, one of the last OAS member states in Latin America to recognize the jurisdiction of the Inter-American Court of Human Rights in 1992. Also, there is, in many ways, broadly speaking, a prevailing perception in Brazil, perhaps, of having a self-contained legal system, and that is kind of combined with a lingering reluctance to accept international scrutiny of domestic human rights record on sovereignty grounds, and this is combined to make made Brazil a relatively kind of a latecomer to regional human rights regime, at least in comparison with its South American neighbors. Yet, of course, it should be noted that Brazil's diplomatic relationship with the system has evolved over time with the Fernando Henrique Cardoso government. Brazil moved from an obstructionist to a more cooperative relationship with the Inter-American system, reaching a number of friendly settlement agreements with the Inter-American Commission in the 90s. And of course, the number of very prominent Brazilian jurists that played an important role within the Inter-American system, of course, Constantine Judge as a long-standing judge of the Inter-American Court, Elio Bicudo, again, a very prominent prosecutor in Sao Paulo, Workers' Party deputy, played an important role in the commission, and of course, Paulo Sérgio Pinedo, who I believe held all different types of human rights positions you can imagine. So a very prominent Brazilian presence diplomatically as well as, if you like, judicially within the Inter-American system. And of course, more recently, Paulo Vanucchi, who became a commissioner on the Inter-American Commission. Now, second dimension just want to highlight here with regards to the relationship between Brazil and and the system here is, if you like, just consider how human rights organizations use this, the Inter-American system. Yeah, if you like, simply put, the demand for the Inter-American system. Now, as a general trend, and this is the burgundy line, there is a fairly significant increase in number of petitions to the Inter-American Commission over the last decades or so. But if from this graph, you can see that in comparative terms, the number of petitions to the Inter-American Commission with regards to Brazil are relatively few. And this is particularly, and this is the thick, a purple line, and this is particularly noteworthy when we're comparing to other Latin American countries. And for those who have good eyes, you can see the just a selection of countries here in comparative terms. And of course, the comparatively small number of cases here, petitions, if you like, is noteworthy, particularly considering the size of Brazil and, of course, the human rights challenges that face that Brazilian society faces. Now, again, there's a historical background to this reluctant engagement with the regional human rights system. Comparatively, few cases were submitted to the Inter-American Commission during the military regime. Following transition, Brazil has had comparatively few dealings with the Inter-American system. And by the mid-1990s, there were only a handful or so of the several hundred cases that were pending before the Inter-American Commission that concerned Brazil. And this pattern of kind of recourse to the American Commission persisted throughout most of the noughties, in fact. However, of course, Brazil has had a very vibrant civil society since the transition, but it has not actively taken recourse to the regional human rights regime. What explains this? Again, there are many knowledgeable people than me have pointed out a number of explanations for this. In the first instance, one of the reasons for the relatively late emergence of strategic human rights litigation in Brazil, for example, has been the dominant role of public prosecutors in taking on human rights cases. Some argue that this has led to a crowding out of legal advocacy by civil society activists. Many Brazilian civil society organizations throughout the 1990s perhaps chose a more explicitly political advocacy strategies over a more legalistic discourse of human rights and international human rights. And also, given very extensive set of rights within the Brazilian constitution, activists have tended to use national law rather than international human rights law. And also, perhaps it should be noted that up until the late 1990s, at least, Brazilian authorities put pressure on the Inter-American Commission not to accept or not to recognize petitions from Brazilian petitioners. So overall, the kind of combined effect here has been a relative lack of awareness within Brazil's human rights community of the resources and opportunities provided by the Inter-American system. However, in recent, decade really, a number of organizations have indeed emerged, such as Conectas, Justicia Global, that are increasingly using strategic litigation and consciously draw on international human rights law, including the American system, in the domestic human rights advocacy. So there have been some shifts, in recent decade, perhaps. The third dimension I just want to highlight here in terms of the relationship between Brazil and the American system broadly, is to consider the extent to which regional human rights standards and instruments are incorporated into the domestic legal system and how jurisprudence of the Inter-American system is used domestically in domestic judicial processes. And of course, clearly, at very formal, basic level, the extent to which international human rights law can be used domestically depends on the extent to which international human rights law treaties have legal effect and standing in domestic law. And indeed, in many Latin American countries, of course, human rights treaties have become constitutionalized. And of course, there's a very distinguished Latin American constitutional tradition that incorporate very extensive human rights protections. And we're very fortunate this year to have Roberto Gagarella, Argentine jurist, as a visiting professor at UCL, and he has written very extensively about this very formal, perhaps formalistic constitutional tradition in Latin America, but it's still very, very significant, again, in regional comparative terms. Yeah. However, as is well known, of course, there's a widespread variation in effective enforcement of human rights within domestic legal systems, and also there's a quite significant differences in the willingness of judges to engage with international human rights law, including the jurisprudence in the American court. Now, what explains this variation is quite a tricky business. Of course, you have issues of judicial independence that can cut both ways. Yeah, but also, of course, in terms of divergent national legal traditions, legal education, engagement more broadly with transnational legal communities, and the judiciaries, particularly high judiciaries in certain countries, that are far more active in this regard than Brazilian judiciary, perhaps. With regards to Brazil specifically, again, hugely generalizing, but perhaps one could say that the Brazilian judiciary has traditionally displayed resistance to international human rights law and institutions. And indeed, in many ways, this constitutional status of international human rights treaties ratified by the Brazilian state appears to be very much of a kind of a matter of legal debate still in Brazil. For example, the Federal Supreme Tribunal has taken quite a restrictive view on the status of international human rights treaties within the Brazilian Constitution. At least, in my understanding, majority position of the Federal Tribunal here is that international human rights treaties have equal status to federal law, and I stand to be corrected broadly on this. But this kind of the kind of equal status with federal law, this is quite a clear contrast, for example, with Argentina, where the main international human rights treaties have constitutional standing. Also in terms of substance, international human rights norms figure prominently in, of course, as I mentioned, all national constitutions across Latin America, but the Argentine constitution is almost a verbatim kind of replica of international human rights treaties. So in this, from this regard, you know, Argentina is exceptionally open to international human rights law. In the case of Brazil, again, simply put, but still perhaps telling, where domestic laws come into conflict with international obligations, domestic law tends to apply. In other words, Brazilian judiciary has traditionally been reluctant to accept the notion that international agreements might override the national constitution and domestic laws. Again, there are some very substantive debates on this matter in Brazilian constitutional law circles, and perhaps there have been some incipient changes towards a more expansive interpretation of the legal status of Brazilian international human rights commitments in relation to the constitution in recent years. However, there appears still to be some ideological resistance among sectors of the Brazilian judiciary to use international human rights law. I should be clear about this. It's not just a matter of being resistant to human rights per se. Many prominent Brazilian lawyers take the view that there's a very ample protection of human rights in the national constitution. Why should we use international human rights law when we have domestic or constitutional rights and fully enshrined? But just to kind of sum this up, compared to most of its regional neighbors, Brazil has been a relative latecomer to the inter-American system, though there have been, as I've tried to emphasize, some changes during the last decade or so. Now, let me now turn to the inter-American system and transitional justice. I was just thinking of summarizing that and let it move on, but let me say a few words on this. Now, in terms of transition justice, for many like myself who look at Brazil from outside and who look at Brazil comparatively from, say, Argentine, even Chilean kind of perspective, Brazil has tended to be viewed as an outlier in South America. Unlike other countries in the region, Brazil has not followed perhaps what many consider to be the pattern challenging self-amnesty laws. The 1979 amnesty law, of course, remains intact, and it was upheld by the Supreme Federal Tribunal in 2010. I'll come back to this point. Brazil, of course, ended its military rule in mid-1980s, but it took until 2012 before there was an official truth commission, national truth commission, I should say, that was created. And there have been some attempts to pursue prosecutions in recent years with regards to the military regime, but such accountability efforts have perhaps not gained much momentum to date. Now, why is this the case? Again, there are a number of explanations, perhaps, for Brazil's perceived transitional justice exceptionalism here, at least in regional terms. And these explanations include, of course, the balance of power during transition with the military very much in charge, the character of the amnesty law as not being a pure self-amnesty by the military regime, but the result of a broader campaign in favor of amnesty. And this has led, and you know, we have one of the experts on the amnesty law here, Marcel Ono, but the status and the amnesty law in Brazil has made it in many ways a reference point to transition justice in ways that it's not so much the case in his neighboring countries. Also, another explanation here is that the comparatively low level of repression during the military regime, that combined with the perception, at least, or the memory of the military pursuing having a good economic performance, though extreme care, of course, needs to be used when evaluating the military's repressive record in particular, because, of course, the military used multiple forms of violence to institutionalize its rule. Another explanation here in terms of the authority and legacies of the military regime that tended to be a highly legalistic, a military form of rule. Strong authoritarian enclaves in democratic Brazil with robust resistance from both the military and parts of the judiciary to revisit the record of the military regime. And of course, transition justice in general, perhaps having a limited political support in Brazil, and perhaps a marginal significance in comparison to other human rights challenges in contemporary Brazil. And as pointed out by Tony Pereira, of course, the Brazilian political system is not very conducive to transition justice policy. Perhaps the political party that many, again, from the outside would view as the party that would have the strongest support for transition justice, the PT, perhaps I'm stand to be corrected here, at best a very ambivalent, lukewarm attitude towards the pursuit of transition justice. And of course, and I think, Tim, you're pointing out this, the presidential coalitional presidential system in Brazil is not conducive to the development of national policies overall with regards to most policy areas, but also perhaps particularly towards issues related to human rights and transition justice. And finally, perhaps Brazil has been comparatively immune to international transition justice pressures. Yeah, and it's this point really that I would like to bring more concretely to the table by discussing the Gomes-Lund case before the Inter-American Court of Human Rights. Now, again, I'm not going to assume that you're all very familiar with the Gomes-Lund case, so let me just very briefly say what Gomes-Lund is about and how and why the case ended up before the Inter-American Court and why the case is significant. And apologies for some of the people here who've heard me said repeating this at various occasions in the last year or so. But now, the Gomes-Lund case is related to the Brazilian military's counterinsurgency campaign against militants of the Brazilian Communist Party in a period of April 1972 to January 1975. And this took place in the Aguaia riverbanks in the state of Pará. Members of the group, they were detained, and after they were identified, they were killed and they were buried secretly. None of the individuals were acknowledged as dead, and they remained in the status of persons who had disappeared for political reasons. In the beginning of the 1980s, there were attempts by family members of some of the disappeared members of the guerrilla to challenge this in court. But these attempts were blocked by a very broad interpretation by judges of the 1979 amnesty law. Now, the amnesty law, of course, was adopted as a measure to facilitate a political opening in Brazil, and it was initially targeting the political crimes committed by those struggling against the military regime. But, of course, the interpretation of the law was extended to include military and police officials who had committed human rights violations. In 1995, after several years of the case being really kicked about in lower courts and court of appeals in Brazil, relatives of the victims, who were represented by several local and international human rights groups, they submitted a petition against the Brazilian state to the Inter-American Commission. And the case was named for Julia Gomes-Lund, whose son Guilherme Gomes-Lund, who's a member of the Araguaja guerrilla, And he was disappeared in 73 when he was 26 years old. Yeah. In October 2008, yeah, so 13 years after the initial submission, the Inter-American Commission finally found in favor of the petitioners. And in March 2009, it submitted a case to the Inter-American Court. Now, the argument of the Commission was effectively the following. The Brazilian government has showed unwillingness until then to declassify documents of the military operations in the Araguaia region. And this unwillingness constitutes a denial of the right to truth. Yeah. The Commission also argued that the Brazilian amnesty law violated Brazil's international human rights obligation to the extent that it prevents the investigation, prosecution and punishment of serious human rights violations, including forced disappearances and extrajudicial executions. Now, in November 2010, the court, Inter-American Court, published its ruling in Gomes Lund. In essence, the court found, and I'm abbreviating here, it found Brazil responsible for the forced disappearances of 62 people between 1972 and 1974 in Araguaia. And it ordered the Brazilian state to investigate and prosecute those who were responsible for the crimes. Now, with regards to the amnesty law specifically, the court argued, and I quote, "The provision of the Brazilian amnesty law that prevents the investigation and sanctioning of severe human rights violations are incompatible with the American Convention, and it had no legal effects and cannot continue to stand in the way of investigating the facts of this case." So the court effectively ordered the Brazilian state to remove all practical and judicial obstacles to investigating the crimes, to establish the truth, as well as the responsibility of those who were involved. The court also emphasized crucially the importance of access to information, including the principle of maximum disclosure and the need to justify any refusal by the Brazilian state to provide information. So these elements, for those of us following the Inter-American Court, this was fairly, was very much expected because the ruling was very much in line with increasingly robust jurisprudence of the Inter-American system of amnesty laws that we referred to a few moments ago. So the Gomes Lund ruling makes Brazil the fourth country in Latin America after Peru, Chile and Uruguay to have its amnesty invalidated by the court. Only Argentina and Uruguay, of course, have to date revoked the respective amnesty laws. Now, what are some of the implications here of the Gomes Lund ruling for transition justice in Brazil? And this is kind of the politics of compliance. So what? Yeah, what's happened since? First, in terms of transition justice, it needs to be recognized, and again, refer to Marcelo for any questions about what has been done in terms of reparations. You know, there's nothing more can be said. But of course, policy of reparations has been very extensive in Brazil. Yeah, and I'm just saying this because myself, I consider a friend sitting here, but this is quite important and significant in terms of transition justice policies that have been implemented. But, of course, it should also be noted, perhaps I should say, that the Brazilian government's at least official response to the Gomes Lund ruling, at least, were slightly more positive than perhaps expected. Paulo Vanucchi, who was then at the time the Secretary for Human Rights, he called the court's decision very important for the development of human rights in Brazil. And he said that we need to find the bodies, we need to establish the truth and so on. So the emphasis on truth and truth finding was very much a kind of the, at least the part of the official response of the Brazilian government. However, with regards to the amnesty law and demands for accountability, just a few months before the Inter-American Court ruling, the Brazilian Supreme Tribunal, as I mentioned, upheld the amnesty law in a ruling. But it should perhaps be noted, and this is often forgotten in the discussion of this ruling, that the tribunal voted 7-2 to uphold the amnesty law, but effectively its ruling said that this is primarily a political matter. Yeah, it's not for us as judges to decide, kind of simplistically put. And it recommended that the Brazilian Congress should take up the issue and consider the future status of the law. Perhaps I'm on record here, but I guess that we know nothing controversial to say that pushing it into the Brazilian Congress would ensure that very little would be done, no? On this matter. But still, the decision by the tribunal perhaps should be interpreted as not in constituting a kind of an obstacle that cannot be overcome. And indeed, Joaquin Barbosa, he suggested in an interview that there is scope for reinterpretation of the amnesty law by the tribunal, should the law become come before the tribunal again. So this raises the question here, does Brazil need to overturn its amnesty law to comply with the Gomes-Lund ruling? The short and simple answer to that is no, not necessarily. After all, it could be, or there could be ways of circumventing the amnesty law as a way of mitigating the impunity effects that such laws may have. There are, of course, examples in Latin America where transitional justice proceeds without amnesty laws being overturned, to some extent in Chile, and, of course, in Argentina prior to the overturning of that country's impunity laws. Yet, perhaps there is a certain momentum building up in Latin America against amnesty laws. Both Argentina and Uruguay have overturned respective amnesty laws. Francesco will say that perhaps this is nothing irrevocable. But still, there perhaps is a kind of some degree of momentum of challenging the law. But there is a further, perhaps, interesting question here in terms of compliance with the International Court ruling, and that is whether, indeed, Brazil has to conduct trials to comply with the International Court ruling. Again, not necessarily. Accountability can come in many different forms, of course, and there are other ways of pursuing accountability, that is, non-criminal forms of accountability. But, of course, the Inter-American Court takes a very strong position in that, and the presumption here is that in the absence of criminal prosecution, there is impunity. So there's a very high barrier here. So in the case of compliance with Gomes-Lund, at the minimum, perhaps a strong case from the perspective of the Inter-American Court is that the responsibility lies with the Brazilian government to demonstrate that any transition justice measure it implements, such as the National Truth Commission, would advance accountability. And this leads me on to the National Truth Commission. And again, the experts in the room, so I'll try to be fairly brief here, but I think the National Truth Commission here is very interesting because, of course, by many it was, and still is to a certain extent, advanced or promoted as a significant advance and a crucial step towards accountability for past violations. Yet there have been various critiques against the National Truth Commission. Many have pointed out that the mandate is fairly limited. Of course, in time it has been extended, but the time period covered, 64 to 85, is fairly extensive. The commission also has the power to call witnesses to investigate abuses, but it has no prosecutorial powers, and in line with the amnesty law, it has no mandate to investigate or condemn suspects. Also, there have been disagreements, of course, within the Truth Commission between the members, apparently from what one can tell from the outside, in terms of how the commission is meant to work and how it can be seen and how it can actually contribute to primary objectives. Now, that those who say or who claim that the commission is important because it can be a catalyst for participation, act as a platform for societal mobilization and for victims. On the other, there are those who say that the role of commission really is primarily about a kind of advancing a quasi-judicial evaluation of evidence and process witness statements and the production of an authoritative report of the commission's finding at the end of the mandate is what matters. Pablo Sergio Pinedo position, if you like. Now, there are indeed strong arguments for both models here, but the main point, at least for observers from the outside, is that there seem, at least until very recently, not be a very clear view within the commission itself of what role the commission should play. And this is a problem for any national truth commission. And of course, the commission has been rocked by resignations and with commissioners not being replaced. And perhaps Dilma herself and the government's public support for the work of the commission has been, again, lukewarm at best. And there are, of course, indications of very strong resistance to the work of the commission from within the military establishment. And perhaps the media coverage, if there is any media coverage, tends to be quite negative, cast the commission in quite negative light. On the other hand, for many, any official transitional justice initiative is better than none. And some argue that the commission constitutes a major advance and it should be welcomed as such. And that it could provide an important catalyst for truth and accountability. Yet, as I said, the Truth Commission mandate include the preservation of the amnesty law, not to challenge the amnesty law. And arguably, it also stands for the preservation of the main impunity effects of the amnesty law. And for many, perhaps this is what to be expected, because from any official transitional justice initiative in Brazil, because these initiatives tended to be led by political elites of various stripes, and they tend to be strongly in favor of kind of having a policy preference for truth over justice, if at all. The main point here, however, amongst these various issues that are raised, is that in terms of compliance with Inter-American Court ruling, the Truth Commission is quite clearly not enough. Yeah. Now, we can only speculate, of course, as to what the future trajectories here may look like. First, it appears highly unlikely, of course, that the Brazilian amnesty law will be overturned. Though it still remains too early to tell, perhaps, whether it will be possible for the Brazilian government, or of any kind, opposed Dilma including, to put a full stop to increasingly, perhaps, concerted legal efforts to hold individual military and police personnel to account. Indeed, there are, at least for some, strong indications that there is a growing momentum with an increasing number of investigations being opened up by prosecutors in Brazil. And the new general prosecutor in September 2013, I think he took office, he has publicly signaled a shift in the interpretation of amnesty law. For example, in response to an extradition request from Argentina with regards to a former police officer who taken exile in Rio Grande do Sul, The general prosecutor argued effectively that there were grounds for extradition because the crimes committed were crimes against humanity and they cannot be amnestied, and this applies to Brazil as well. Yeah, so open up a judicial avenue for criminal prosecution. Now, the relative strength of this momentum, if at all, towards criminal prosecution remains to be seen. But perhaps there are indeed signals that may possibly indicate a future circumvention of the amnesty law in order to pursue some form of judicial accountability for crimes committed. In other words, the most likely pathway to accountability, judicial accountability, I should specify here, if any, would resemble a Chilean model rather than the Argentine or the Uruguayan model of accountability. Now, I think that leads me to a conclusion, last 5 to 10 minutes. Do I have five?
Yeah.
Yeah?
You do.
Now, and I kind of just, I guess in my mind, when I try to keep this as simple as possible for me, this is so what? Gomeshlum, so what? What's the broader relevance and significance of this? So let me just emphasize three points, perhaps, to how to open up a thought process of this significance of Gomeshlund and the processes set in motion, if at all, Gomeshlund, that goes beyond looking strictly at past human rights abuses. First, the lack of compliance with Gomeshlund, now we are 3 years on, by the Brazilian state, raises concerns, of course, that go beyond the absence of accountability for past human rights violation. Most clearly, perhaps, the Gomeshlund case has highlighted some of the continuing tensions in Brazilian civil-military relations. True, of course, the Brazilian military's long-held suspicions and opposition to a truth commission eased somewhat since the ruling of the Federal Tribunal, when it upheld the interpretation of the 1979 amnesty law. Yet, the military, again, I stand to be corrected here, they have broadly resisted calls for cooperation with the commission, including, of course, refusing to provide access to military archives. Yeah? Again, I might stand to be corrected. I'm happy to be proven that I'm mistaken on this point. But it seems to me that by implementing the Inter-American Court ruling, therefore, the Brazilian government has opportunity here to further strengthen effective civilian control over military affairs. Moreover, one of the most important aspects of Gomeshlund, perhaps, is the affirmation of victims' right to access to information. The Brazilian government, and the ruling stated here, and I quote, is required to continue developing initiatives for the search, systematization, and publication of all information about the Araguaia guerrilla, along with information relating to human rights violations that occurred during the military regime, and guarantee access to this information, end of quote. So the Gomeslund, at least a year or so back, the ruling appeared to feed into important legislative debates in Brazil that led to the entry into law of entry into force of the new access to information law in Brazil. So, in short, complying with Gomeslund and pushing these issues of right to access to information could strengthen this very important cluster of rights regarding state accountability, regarding transparency, freedom of information, and the right to truth. And it would shift the responsibility to the state to provide public justifications for why information should be secret, rather than what seemed to be the prevailing thought process that I had to make. Had to make a case for why the public should know. Yeah. So at least there are some connections here, it seems to me, between the rise of the past, present, and the future that are quite apparent, if you like, when thinking through the implications of this case. Now, the second aspect of Gomeslund case concerns more broadly Brazil's relationship with the inter-American system and compliance with the international human rights by the Brazilian state more generally. Again, I've been going over these points for quite some time now, but at least, Brazilian, as I mentioned in the beginning here, Brazilian states have quite a reluctant engagement with the inter-American system. But of course, the inter-American system provides a significant set of resources and if you like, norms and standards, whether it with regards to abuses committed by police and security forces and indigenous rights to ancestral lands. And the kind of the important emphasis here on issues of accountability, victims' rights, and reparations. And these developments and the kind of strengthening of the system in this normative sense has already had significant implications for Brazil. The Maria da Penha law that was adopted many years back now was an example of how individual cases can be used to effectively legislate important advances with regards, in this case, women's rights and prosecution of domestic violence. So the inter-American system has inserted itself in other human rights issues in Brazil, as the increasing kind of caseload indicates. But of course, in terms of implementation, there are a range of various problems. The federal system is one in terms of the kind of mismatch between federal recognition of the importance of the inter-American system and the sub-national, the state level reluctance to implement concretely rulings. But for many, there is a strong argument for why the Brazilian government needs to take the inter-American system more seriously. In practice, in terms of concrete engagement on specific cases, the inter-American system has faced either, Brazilians say that ignored rulings or choosing not to implement substantial measures. And of course, for those who followed the Belo Monte case, the response of the Brazilian government and Dilma personally was, again, quite strong and negative both for the inter-American system and Brazil. However, of course, there's been a kind of somewhat of a return to the status quo with Paulo Vanucchi taking up his position at the Inter-American Commission. But this being said, there's still quite a significant tension, of course, that exists between Brazil and the Inter-American Commission and the court. And this brings me perhaps to the final point. And I've been, again, making this for quite some time now, concerning the significance of Brazil's relationship with the Inter-American system. Now, simply put, I think my argument is this. The relationship between the Inter-American system and Brazil matters partly because of what it means for a so-called rising state to engage internationally and to accept external scrutiny and to respond to such scrutiny constructively. For example, in the case of Gomeslund, what are we really talking about here? We're talking about whether it's legitimate for the Brazilian state to disappear, torture, and extrajudicially execute its citizens. Now, these are, of course, events of the past, but it is up to the Brazilian state and society in the present to attempt to repair the harm done, and crucially, put in place preventive mechanisms and institutions that ensure that similar acts are not committed in the present, which of course they are. Yeah. Moreover, the Brazilian state's relationship with the mega system matters here because of what it reveals about the character of Brazil's leadership, both regionally and globally. The absence of Brazilian regional leadership is particularly noteworthy in the area of transition justice, and I already alluded to this in terms of Brazilian exceptionalism. And beyond Latin America, it could be argued that the international dimensions of its human rights obligations are particularly important for Brazil. The Brazilian government has sought, at least up until very recently, to play a more prominent role in international areas of kind of conflict prevention and resolution, and it has sought, at least up until very recently, to insert itself as an international norm entrepreneur with regards, for example, its notion of responsibility while protecting. Now, the point is not about kind of highlighting hypocrisy in terms of the gap between what is said and what's being done, but the connection here, I think, is important between what Brazilian government says and does at home and what it says and does abroad. And of course, many make explicit links between Brazilian government's record and policies on international human rights and its potential for regional and global leadership. And I would argue this is particularly important as we spoke about earlier, for Brazil, because of what it claims to represent as something different from, say, China, something different from even perhaps India and South Africa. Yeah. Now, for example, just leave you finally with the kind of long quote here. So this is from Viviana Krstievich, who's the executive director of CEJIL, Center for Justice and International Law. And this is one of the organizations that brought the Gomes Lund case to the Inter-American Human Rights System. And here, Viviana and others with her make an explicit link between Brazilian government's lack of progress on transition justice and its potential for regional leadership. Yeah, so I kind of leave you to read this. Now, whatever merits, whether you agree or not with these links between what Brazil says and does at home and abroad and so on and so forth, no matter what you think about the merits of such arguments, the important point here is that they are being made, yeah, and that creates a set of expectations. And these expectations are perhaps only likely to increase. Yeah, so I'll just leave it like that on that kind of more ambiguous point, and happy to bring it up in discussion. So thank you for your attention.